Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, America. I'm Chad Pagano. I'm a former Army sniper, a chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education right here in New York City, and an avid, lifelong hunter, and you are listening to The Wild Game Domain, From the Hunt to the Hearth, airing live on the heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks for joining me again. Welcome back. Here we are. I'm all by my big self today, so I'm going to try to keep you entertained here. But I'm fired up a little bit, so it should get interesting. I'm going to try to stay calm and present the facts. That's what I'm going to do today, so bear with me. But I wanted to talk about, we're really getting to the heart of the New York State archery deer season here, bear season, turkey season. And I've been out in the woods up at my camp in Delaware, and Delaware County, New York. And it started real slow, you know, October 1st. It was hot, 70 degrees. And this is the first year hunting this property we have access to now, my partner and I. And, you know, we had scouted it out all summer and did our research and hung some stands. We had hung, four stands, two guys, four stands, two each, and a blind, and, you know, really did some work. And so the first week, we proceeded to hunt, I don't know, 40 hours or so, and we did not see a deer. I saw chipmunks, squirrels, plenty of turkey, but not a deer. So I started to worry, but I had to talk myself off the ledge and say, calm down, the deer are here, you've seen the sign, you've got the pictures, it's too hot, the deer are nocturnal, they're running at night. So second week, we had hunted, we laid off a little bit, relaxed, let everything calm down. Went back third week, and it was cold. We got that cold front that came in. And we hunted a good 10, 20, 30-something hours, 40 hours on stand, I'm talking, you know, over a couple of days. And I counted 18, give or take, 18, 20 deer in that time. I saw the buck of my life. I didn't have a shot at it, but I'm on him now. He was behind me. I missed a doe. I missed a chip shot at 20 yards, which, you know, right after the shot, you know, if you're a hunter, you know about that. If you're not, I'll tell you the story real quick. I was hunting one of my buddy's stands. I had seen some deer movement. I could almost through the woods now that the leaves are gone from one of my stands. I could almost see his area. It's about 300 yards through the woods. And I saw a lot of deer movement through there that morning. So I said, you know what? Let me try that. In the afternoon, came back, had a little lunch, got back out there early, set up, and I don't know, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I heard a little crunch behind me. I had a fully mature doe standing behind the tree stand, not 10 yards from me. You know, she'd crept in, and so, you know, the first thing is, all right, am I gonna use my tag on a? I get one archery tag, right? So am I gonna use it on a doe? So you know how the wild game domain operates. It's about eating meat. It's not about trophies. But I said, wow, it's really early in the season. I don't know. Let's see what she does. So she walked under the stand, got out in front of me. You know, she was grazing a little bit, knocking up the leaves. There's an old oak there. So I guess she was looking for some acorns. And she proceeded to walk out about 20 yards and turn broadside. So I said, you know what? She's dead. I got to take care of this now. She did it to herself. Turned broadside on an archery hunter at 20 yards. You got to pay the price. So slowly stood up. I guess I made a little, you know, obviously made a little movement as I'm standing up. But she kind of glanced over. I froze. She put her head back down. And she was kind of, it was funny. She was over this dead log at an angle. Imagine a log coming back at me at like a 45 degree angle. And she was kind of quartering away slightly, her front two legs over the log, her back two legs behind the log. And she kept moving her head left and right over the log. And at one point she put her head down behind it. And that's when behind the log, and I drew back. And, I realized I was on my friend's stand, who I had never hunted this stand before, and it's a ladder stand, so it has a very narrow platform on it, on this style of tree stand. So I drew back, and I couldn't get the sight picture, so I let the arrow back down. I let the bow back down, and she looked up again. She sent, you know, she saw some movement. She's only 20 yards from me, and I froze, and she put her head back down. So I fixed my glasses. I wear glasses. I thought maybe my glasses were down on my nose. I couldn't get the sight picture. We have a rear sight, the front pins, everything's got to line up. I drew back again. And again, I used what's called a kisser button on my line. It's a little marker, a little plastic nub, we'll call it, on my bowstring that comes back to the corner of my mouth. So you're assuring the same sight picture every time you draw your bow. And I had the kisser button right in my lip. And I still couldn't get a good angle. And I thought, what the hell's going on? Now I'm starting to shake a little bit. I'm like, I'm going to blow this. Now it's a mission. I got to get this doe. Really, what I should have done is sat back down and said, you know what? Something's wrong. Let her enjoy her day. But I didn't. I made the mistake of drawing back once again on her. And I got somewhat of a picture through my sight. It wasn't my normal picture, but I was on the green pin. That's my 20-yard pin. And I put it right on her vitals, and I was kind of tilting my head the way I in a way I normally wouldn't. And I released the arrow, thinking it's a 20-yard chip shot. No matter, even if I'm off a little bit, I'm still in that, what we call the pie plate, the kill zone of the animal. The arrow goes. I hear it hit. Usually when it hits an animal, you hear a thump. That's the sound. And I heard that. I heard thump, and she jumped up and ran about 10 yards away and was kind of looking back to where she was standing. And at this point, now I'm looking at her and I'm like, all right, I got her. Got her good, because she's not even running. And within a few seconds, it dawned on me that I'm looking at the same side that I just shot, supposedly, and there's no blood pouring from this animal. And she's not wounded, her tail's not up. And I said, wow, did I miss? And I'm a little confused. Now I'm looking back to where she was, and I'm trying to find my arrow embedded in the ground. I thought it had passed through her, and I can't see the arrow. I use orange fletching on mine, and you know, all the leaves are down, the fall colors are in on the ground, and I couldn't see it from where I was. And she just decided to make a U-turn and just walk off. I didn't even spook her. She had no idea I was there still. So I hunted the rest of that day, saw a couple of deer out in the distance, and just beating myself up over a missed doe, and got out of tree stand, go to try to find my arrow, and I find it embedded about, 10 or 12 inches into this log right where she was standing. I had shot right under, looking at the angle now back from where I found my arrow embedded in this log to the tree stand. I had missed her, by maybe an inch or so. I had shot right under her vitals, and it embedded in this log. My first thought was, how'd I screw this shot up? So I went back to the tree stand, and I got back up in it, and I was looking at the angle, and now I pull back, and I realized what I was doing. I usually turn a little sideways when I'm firing my bow, and on my stands, the way it's set up, I'm allowed, I have the width of the stand to allow the footwork to happen, the proper placement of my feet. In my buddy stand, I noticed it was only probably about 10 inches wide, so I must have instinctively put my feet, back. So I was standing basically facing her, so I didn't have the right angle. And you heard me move my head there away from the mic. I'm doing it as I talk to you. And I didn't have the right alignment on the bow. And then you would think, and maybe new bow hunters or people new to hunting or people who've never hunted think I'm very upset about this. And, I wasn't at all. First of all, we have a saying, if you're not missing, you're not hunting enough. That's archery. You're going to miss. There's no way around it. That's the point of, that's what makes, that's the draw to archery hunting. It's hard. It's not easy. to harvest one of these brilliant animals with a even modern bow. You know, I have a state-of-the-art setup, but it's still not easy. My one thought was actually happiness. I was overjoyed that, first of all, I had done something really, really stupid and got away with it. Never take the shot unless you know you have it. You know, shoot within your limitations. And because the last thing we ever want to do is wound one of these beautiful animals and have them go suffer and die out in the field and not be able to harvest, you know, or use that beautiful animal. So, you know, it was a clean miss. The arrow was there. I found the evidence. I pulled the arrow out of the log. I was like Excalibur trying to get this thing out of the log. I tried to pull it out straight so I could, you know, I didn't want to bend it. It's carbon arrow. It's pretty flexible, but I couldn't get it. So I started, you know, back and forth wobbling, and it finally came out. Just tell you, if you're an archery hunter, you know what I'm talking about. The Rage Broadhead went right into that log, buried. It opened. It's a mechanical broadhead, and opened up in the log, and it came out cleanly. I don't know if I bent my arrow up. I'm going to have to test shoot it. But just wanted to give you an update where I am. I'll be hunting later this week, so hopefully by the next show I come back with an archery tag filled in. So today's show was really... Thank you for joining us for today's New York State hunting update. So that's where I am. Weather is supposed to be real good this week. We should be good, so I'm going to get one this week. I'm feeling confident. I was going to do a show on venison farming today. I had a guy lined up. He bailed out. I was still going to do it. I was, you know, an interesting subject because, you know, I'm out there trying to harvest wild venison, but if you can't or if you're not a hunter, how do you enjoy some of these great recipes we've been giving you on the show? Well, you go to a farm-raised venison, and it's different in some ways, but it's still delicious. So I was going to do a whole show about that. But believe it or not, I got an email. I got an email on the Wild Game domain. I guess someone had heard the show, this person, and decided to email me about his or her objections to hunting. And listen, I'm a libertarian. You want to object? Let's have a conversation about it. And my response to this person was, you're ignorant. You really don't know what you're talking about. You're talking with emotions. You know, you really have no clue about hunting and conservation and what the sportsmen of this country do for really all natural resources in this country. And so I replied and I said, you know, why don't you join me or why don't you call my show and we could have a discussion about it? Because that's what I do. I'm the bigger man. I try to educate the ignoramuses who don't understand what they're talking about. And they proceeded to get more angry and write me a second email that said I was less of a man. And that's why I tell you in my intro that I'm an army sniper because I don't feel good about my manhood. And that's why I kill animals. I guess to project this manly aura about me, which I really have, I don't care. You don't think I'm a man, that's fine. But it forced my hand, and now I'm going to do a show about conservation. I want to talk to you today basically about the what we call, or what conservationists, what hunters call, the North American model of wildlife conservation. And I want to talk to you today about the seven principles of this model that basically assures that the animals are there, that the conservation of these animals will be long-lasting, and that it will protect, this model protects the great resources we have available to us here in this country. And, you know, natural resources in all, you know, including wildlife, especially wildlife for me as a hunter, represent the health and, you know, obviously the wealth of a country and the people of that country. What is a country? To me, a country is more than land, right? It's the people, it's the community. So, you know, this wildlife represents the health and wealth of a country and its people. And as a hunter, or really as a citizen of this great country, we are fortunate to have this system, this model in place that recognizes the value of what we have available to us. And this model will dictate the proper use and management of all the resources. So That's what I want to really get to, and hopefully my ignorant friend, and let's not get mad. I got into a fight once with my wife. I called her ignorant, and I love her to death, and she was arguing with me about something. And I said, listen, I'm not going to argue with you. You're ignorant about this. Ignorance is just a lack of knowledge about a certain subject matter, and that's all I'm saying, so don't get all crazy. I'm not calling you an idiot. I'm not calling you anything else. You're just ignorant, and I'm going to try to help you out today, my emailing friend. But this is perfect. We're going to take a short break. And we're going to be right back with the Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org.
Underground Meats is an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. They use small farms from southwest Wisconsin to source their meat. The animals are raised on pasture for their entire lives by farmers who care about animal welfare. While Underground Meats uses European traditions, they also use ingredients from the upper Midwest to try to create new types of salamis, experimenting with both ingredients and techniques. The salamis are made using heritage breeds, mostly red wattles, tamworths, berkshires, and mule foots. Try their award-winning cured pork shoulder and goat salami. To learn more and purchase products, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin.
You are listening to The Apothecary by Brothers NYC here on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, America, welcome back. I'm your host, Chad Pagano, and you're listening to the Wild Game Domain on heritageradionetwork.org. All right, so let's get to this. I got 15 minutes left. The North American Model of Wildlife Conservation. First of all, I'm going to plug an organization at the end of the show, but let's start with a quote. Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy, good old Teddy Roosevelt, and this was the quote. Wildlife and its habitat cannot speak, so we must and we will speak for the wildlife. And that's well said. I mean, that's it. And that's what I'm trying to do today. I know people have this, some people have this perception of hunters being, you know, beer swilling hillbillies playing their banjos and getting drunk and, I don't know, massacring animals. But there are, that is, you know, nothing could be further from the truth. So the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation, all right? And this model is guided by really seven principles, and it's really developed over time. And really out of necessity to reverse, I guess you would call it, negative effects from, and as a libertarian, constitutional libertarian, I can't believe I'm about to say this, under regulation from the government. We had no regulations and, you know, we basically decimated the wildlife populations of this country because we were under regulating. You know, we had no rules in place, so people are greedy. Human nature, they're going to go out and take more than they need, and they're going to try to make money off this stuff. So over time, these seven principles developed that we used, and all of these principles, basically this model is anchored by a Supreme Court decision that basically said that wildlife, and here's the real point here, wildlife belongs to the people. You ready? The people. We the people. Not the government, the people. It doesn't belong, wildlife does not belong to corporations. And really, it doesn't even belong because the people, right? The people, remember that. It doesn't even belong to individuals. It doesn't even belong to me by myself. I'm part of it, but it doesn't. Dedrick, my man, producing today's show, love the guy. It belongs to him. It belongs to I. It belongs to this girl sitting out the window here eating pizza. It belongs to the people, and it needs to be protected. And no one cares about protection of wildlife more than me. So I want to go through these seven principles, really. And it starts with the public trust. In the public trust, you may have heard this term before relating to other things. But the wildlife is what they're talking about. Wildlife belongs to the people and is managed in trust for the people by the government, that's supposed to represent us, the people, right? Now, I know I argue that government is ever expanding and out of control and really, you know, doing a great job of squashing our individual freedoms and rights that we and our forefathers have fought for in this country. I know I've done that, so I sound like I'm contradicting myself a little bit here, but I've also on the show since day one praised the Department of Environmental Control for the most part, especially in their relationship to hunters and the wildlife and taking care of and keeping these animals in trust for the good of all the people. So, you know, they're a well-run and a well-run government. They're a well-run and well-funded government agency that does a really great job at protecting the wildlife through licensing, educational programs, tagging, scientific initiatives. The DEC is responsible for all of this stuff, representing the people to take care of these animals. So, you know, the Supreme Court's the one that decided, you know, wildlife is owned by the people, and therefore we need to take care of it. You know, this comes from our descendants who, you know, we're descendant of Europe, right? Europe, in monarchies, the people did not own wildlife. The king, the queen, the monarchy owned the wildlife. We weren't even allowed to touch the wildlife. Very little hunting from the peasants like me were allowed. So in the new world, we decided, you know what? The people own it. The government, Obama doesn't own it. Boehner doesn't own it. Ted Cruz, love you, but you don't own it. Rand Paul, I own it, so take care of it for us. So that was the first and most important step in this model, just the public trust. We need to take care of this. We need to fund this agency, this government agency, to allow for this trust to exist. The second principle that we attribute to this model is the prohibition. And this was, again, I'm going basically in order as I feel importance. As far as this model is concerned, the prohibition on commerce of dead wildlife. Back in the day, we basically slaughtered all the buffalo, we slaughtered all the turkey, we slaughtered all the deer for commercial reasons. We were selling it, we were trading it. So we decided, you know what? As a country, it will be illegal to sell the meat of any wild animal in North America, period. Put a period on it, done, don't even bother. I know everyone wants to go make a buck, but you can't. That's it. It's not about that. It's owned by the people, and it's for our enjoyment, not for commercial use. Now, you know, we were going to do a show about venison farming. That's farming. That's different. That's covered, you know, through different laws. You cannot set up a company or go out by yourself, kill an animal, and sell it to someone. That is illegal. You've broken the law. And that did... that did a lot for the health of these herds. The harvesting of wildlife for commercial markets contributed greatly to the extinction of a lot of the species we have here in North America, the turkey, the deer I mentioned. You know, it was basically, you know, hunters and sportsmen who noticed, wow, where'd all the animals go? We're out here. I was hunting this spot last year and there were 10 deer. Now there's one. What's going on? So, you know, with, we had a great senator, John F. Lacey, who proposed this idea of prohibiting commercial value to wild game meat. And basically that spelled the end of, you know, market hunting in this country, and it allowed the wildlife to recover and flourish in this country. So, and that was, we're looking at probably, don't quote me on this, 1900, there was two Lacey acts and he got it somewhat right in 1900, and then like in 1907 he reintroduced some amendments, I guess they are, to the act and fixed it up and made it impossible to make money off a wild game. So again, going in order of importance, we have in the public trust, we have prohibition on commerce on dead wildlife. And then the next principle is the allocation of wildlife is by law. laws developed by the people and enforced by the government agency will regulate the proper use of wildlife resources. The mere presence of man on the landscape can negatively affect wildlife and habitats that support them. The rule of law, instead of the rule of chance, will be used to govern the appropriate use of these wildlife resources. Okay? So, in cooperation with this government agencies, hunters, scientists, nature lovers, conservationists, work closely with this agency to protect the whole landscape, not just the wildlife, but the trees, the grass, the fields, the rivers, the habitat of the wildlife. And they establish laws, rules that we have to abide by. You can't hunt at night. You can't go on this property during certain times. We don't hunt animals at will. We can't decide, you know, the best time to hunt turkey is now. We allow for breeding cycles in certain animals. We allow the pressure to be taken off these animals. And this is all done through the allocation of wildlife by law. Very, very important. Some people would say, some of my libertarian friends would say, oh, it's too much, it's too vague, and the government, we're talking about one aspect of wildlife and conservation, a big part of our government. And again, DEC people out there, I love you guys. You're the one agency after the revolution that I'm going to put back into effect immediately after we break up about 98% of our over-bloated government. The next principle, opportunity for all. Every citizen, ready, has a freedom to hunt and fish. It's a freedom. Through this model, it's a freedom. It's yours. Congratulations. Believe it or not, even now, modern times, the year 2013, there are a lot of countries in this world where you cannot go out and hunt. It is not one of your freedoms. It is not a right that exists to you. Well, here, we have that right. You, through the proper laws, by observing the proper laws and going through the system, you can go ahead and go out and hunt and fish. And to me, that means harvesting an animal. To other guys I hunt with, and it's about going to sit in a tree stand or on the edge of a cliff and just watch the chipmunks and the squirrels and the crows. They don't even care. It's about being part of it and helping the conservation of these animals. So opportunity for all means, you know, also public access to wildlife, where they live, regardless of, you know, your social or really economic status. Anybody's welcome to go out to a national park and go watch the wildlife. And this includes hunting, fishing, trapping, as long as you're following the law. It's the right of citizenship in this country. You can't take it away. Too bad. And this access will foster individual stewardship of the land, of the animal, of this whole process, right? I feel it. I feel it just through this radio show today. It's ours. I own it. I'm part of it, right? With Dedrick, with the girl eating the pizza out and the thing, we all take part. Dedrick doesn't do anything except produce my show, but I don't even care. I don't even hate him for it. He's part of it. He doesn't even know it. He pays his taxes. He's not a tax cheat. And this all helps the maintaining of these animals. Another principle, non-frivolous use. In North America, we can legally kill certain wildlife for legitimate purposes under strict guidelines for food and fur, in self-defense or property protection. Laws are in place to restrict casual killing. Killing for commercial purposes, we already talked about. The wasting of game and mistreating of wildlife. If you're a rancher, you're allowed to kill the wolf. He's eating your cattle. You're allowed to kill him. And 90% of the ranchers will take and harvest that animal in a responsible way and try to use it as much as possible. Maybe the fur. Maybe they eat the wolf. So this idea that none of the killing is done callously. Is very important to the whole system by which we hunt. The rules of proper use in the written law, you know, that the government tells, DEC tells us, the government tells us there's a certain way to do this. But really, it reflects in this model through personal ethics, the ethics I take to the field with me. There was a chipmunk annoying me the other day. It was turning up the leaves in front of my tree stand all day, all morning. Didn't see a deer, stupid chipmunk. Did I shoot the chipmunk? Of course not. That wouldn't be ethical. First of all, it's not chipmunk season. I'm not going to eat the chipmunk. Chipmunk's living its life. So the chipmunk survived. So, you know, non-frivolous use of the animal is what really this show's about. The idea that wildlife, here's another principle, the idea, and we're getting there. I'm almost perfect timing, Dedrick. I'm like a pro. I'm getting good at this. The idea that wildlife is an international resource, you know, wildlife in general, and fish, you know, fish comes to mind, birds, geese, they migrate across boundaries, freely migrate, right? We can't stop them. We don't put nets up between Canada and the United States. The birds are allowed to fly. The river crosses the United States into Canada, Canada into the United States. We don't put up a brick wall and make a dam to prevent the water from flowing, and the fish don't give a crap if they're American or Canadian. The geese doesn't care. They need to migrate freely across boundaries, these whatever it is, a state, a province, even break it down into our own country, across state lines, county lines, whatever you want to, whatever line, imaginary line as far as the wildlife is concerned, you want to establish as a person. So it's an international resource, and, you know, sportsmen, hunters in general have, you know, we were the first to recognize this and understand and pressure our government to apply international or work for international treaties and laws, to save the animals, to help, you know, waterfowl, as an example, you know, migrating, any kind of migrating bird, you know, the example is, wild fowl that nested in Alaska needed to migrate to certain areas. And so we had to set up these treaties to allow for the proper migration and protection once the birds migrated from here to there and vice versa. And really, it's a success story, these international agreements we have, especially in North America. And mainly between Canada and the United States, the agreements we've established through international treaty have been amazing and have been nothing but a boom for the wild game in this country. And the last thing I want to talk about, the last principle is the wildlife is not managed by our heart or by our feelings. Those things all exist for me, man. This is a spiritual undertaking when I go hunting, within reason. But we manage the wildlife by science. It's sciences applied to this. The best science available will be used as a base for an informed decision or any decision we make in wildlife management. And that's why I'm going to do, and this is where I'm going to do my plug right now. There is an organization, if you're not a member of it, you need to be, and it's the Boone and Crockett Club. I already mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. He was the founder of this organization, the Boone and Crockett Club. And whether you're a hunter or not, if you just care about wildlife, if you want to see the existence of this animal and foster it and all this country's natural resources, the Boone and Crockett Club does an amazing job. And it was founded by Theodore Roosevelt, and who was a strong advocate of science. And he wanted to apply the best science available in making these, what we'd call big, critical decisions on natural resource management. The club began by providing money for some of the first wildlife research projects that got underway so we could better understand these animals and better protect them. Some of you hunters may, I hope you're aware of this club, you know, the Boone and Crockett Club, but one of its, also one of its members, Aldo Leopold, hence the scope, right, the rifle scope, the club began formulating flexible scientific management policies for wildlife that the government basically adopted and used. So the club also called for the first President's Conference on Outdoor Recreation, which led to the establishment of the National Recreation Policy, which coordinated resource management at all levels of government, the federal, state, and local levels, so they could coordinate through the scientific research and really foster the wildlife and the all natural resources that we have in this country. So I hope that helps my friend who emailed me understand where I'm coming from as a hunter. I'm not just some hillbilly that puts on his orange clothes and drinks a bottle of bourbon and goes out shooting up the countryside. I care immensely and respect these animals deeply. Every time I eat them, the thought of their life and how they contribute to our life and the resources of this country in general come to mind. And I welcome you, anybody out there who disagrees with me or wants to discuss this, because really this is the guts of this show. This is what this show is about. It's to promote hunting, to promote wild game and more natural way of life in general. So I hope that helped out, and I hope you guys found that entertaining. And actually, I was bragging. That's what I do. I get all arrogant, and I went over about 5 minutes, so I apologize, and I'll do better next time. But that's all the time we have. And I'd like to thank my man Dedrick for producing and engineering today's show. You can find archived episodes of the Wild Game Domain from the Hunt to the Hearth on heritageradionetwork.org or iTunes as a podcast. Check out the website. Apparently some of you guys are, and emailing me, wildgamedomain.com. And we're live every Tuesday. If you ever want to call the show, call in 718-497-2128, or you could email us here at the studio, info@heritageradionetwork.org. Talk to you guys next week, and don't forget, if you kill it, you better eat it. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.